Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, reporting for duty.
And before we get to this week's conundrum, weirdest romances, we have some news to talk about.
Very exciting, Cam. I texted you immediately upon finding this out. Today, as we record, it's just been revealed that writer, creator, producer Brian Fuller will be co-creating and showrunning Star Trek 2017 come next January. Cam, your reaction to this? Obviously, I was very excited.
I have so much to say, Tyler. So much to say.
Well, you know what? I think what we can do is go much more in depth next week. We'll just touch upon it this week. But the reason why I'm very excited about this is because Brian Fuller, I've been following his career since all the way Deep Space Nine. He wrote Empath Nor, The Darkness and the Light as a freelancer. He moved on to Voyager. He did a lot of fun, kind of high concept episodes like Drone.
Spirit Folk,
our favorite. But also Course Oblivion. That's a great one there. Bride of Chaotica is very memorable.
Yeah, sure.
For certain reasons. But hey, and there, you're going to get there soon enough, Cam. In season 7, I think, but like Workforce Part 2 were introduced, I believe that was the ECH, the Emergency Command Hologram.
Oh, nice.
He's a lot of cool things in his repertoire, including what I've talked about quite a bit on the show, Hannibal, which I've just been absolutely in love with the past 3 years. Just stylistically, I don't think there's a more beautiful show that was on TV. So I just think the directions that this will take the franchise, and just like what, honestly, by the time we get to Enterprise, it just had a very flat look to it, you know. And I'm talking about like when we talk about kind of the lighting, the cinematography, we're talking about like just how maybe colors pop, how they shoot things from certain ways, you know, like different angles, the lighting on screen as well. So I think he's got a great eye for it. The other reason I'm very excited is this guy has a knack for casting people. Go back to Wonder Falls, great cast there. Hannibal, you've got like Hugh Dancy, Mads Mikkelsen, Larry Fishburne.
Gillian Anderson,
yeah. Like, she was great on that show.
Has she ever not been great?
No, never. Yeah. So, you know, maybe it's very obvious casting choice there.
Right.
The other reason, I'll go into it a little bit more depth, you know, next week as well. Okay, I've been like practicing questions for like Las Vegas this year, you know.
In the mirror,
you know.
Do you play both parts?
I've been holding a blow dryer up to my mouth pretending it's the microphone. No, but because I assume, and I think you and I talked about this, I forget if it was on the podcast, but like we figured like the new showrunner would have been hired by this summer, and then he or she would likely make an appearance at Las Vegas.
Yeah.
Knowing that it's Brian Fuller, like, the question that I wanted to talk to this guy about is kind of diversity.
Yeah.
I think, like, and for the conundrum that we have this week, I was, like, looking at, like, kind of the history of sexuality on Star Trek. It's sad.
Yeah.
But even just, like, kind of sexual diversity, like, Brian Fuller, he's been openly gay for years. I think this is probably going to be the time that we have, like, an LGBTQ character. It would make sense, and I'm not talking about Q as in Q continuum, but you know, I think it'd be great for you know, casting diversity. He's done interviews in the past saying that he would like to have done a series about the USS Reliant with like Angela Bassett as kind of the captain of the ship,
yeah.
Rosario Dawson as the first officer. I think, you know, just getting like a real diverse cast is very important after, I don't know, we've had, I don't know, Star Trek has a bit of a mixed bag when it comes to kind of the captains. We've got a lot of white dudes, and yeah. You know, we do have like a black dude and a white female captain as well. Mm-hmm. So, I don't know, Cam, I've been just spreading the
You're
love.
Gushing.
I'm gushing. I am so excited about this hiring, because here's the thing. I'll quickly wrap it up because we've got a great conundrum this
week.
Yes,
we do.
But, and yes, wrap it up, Tyler. That's what you're thinking. I was actually
I'm reaching the hook around your neck right now.
I was thinking about yesterday about how it would be cool if Ron Moore would be, you know, show running this, but he's got like other shows that are such as The Bodice Ripper, known as Outlander, that he's working on right now. It's unlikely. But I was thinking about it. Like, I've already seen Ron Moore's new iteration of Star Trek, which is essentially Battlestar Galactica.
Right.
And then I was thinking, you know what? Who I haven't seen is Brian Fuller, you know, like a former writer. That's why I'm so excited about what his new vision of Star Trek could be.
And what he could kind of do, let off the leash.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. Like, I mean, I've mentioned it, you know, Hannibal, very dark show.
Yeah.
His other shows, like Wonder Falls, like very light, very bright, optimistic. He said in past interviews he wants to kind of bring a certain optimism back to Star Trek as well.
Right.
So I'm very, very excited about this hiring.
Yeah.
Cam, knowing as little as you do about this guy, but just maybe based on reactions from your co-host or other people online, what do you think about this?
I mean, I'm excited. I've seen, you know, obviously his panels in Vegas, and I've seen his two DS9 episodes, which are both fantastic, and I've referenced on this podcast. What interests me the most, and I say this without watching much of his work, I'm going to do a deep dive into research for next week's episode, which we'll do a full episode on this news. But what encourages me the most is that here's a guy who's took a property that could not have been more boring, at like from being overdone, and made it interesting with Hannibal.
Yes.
Because, I mean, by the time Hannibal Rising came out, no one wanted to see that character ever again in pop culture. And yet he made a show that was, you know, loved by many and, you know, critically acclaimed. So I'm really interested to see what he can do with a property that, while we don't think Star Trek is boring or used up or whatever, I think a lot of the sort of mainstream feeling towards Star Trek on TV is that it's tired and done. So I'm really curious to see what he can do to change more of the popular mainstream perception.
I mean, this is a guy who's obviously been thinking about doing a Star Trek series for decades.
Yeah.
And he must have ideas. I'll just cap it off with this one tweet. You already touched upon kind of why you're excited about this, but this really, I had to retweet it earlier today. This is from my favorite television critic, Alan Sepinwall. He tweeted, "After Hannibal, few producers I trust more than at Brian Fuller to find new life in a very familiar franchise."
Right.
I couldn't agree more. I'm very excited about this. We're going to have lots more to talk about in the coming weeks and months, but why don't we start on our latest conundrum, Cam?
Yes, this is the special Valentine's Week episode where we are going to talk about the weirdest relationships in Star Trek or the weirdest romances.
We had a lot of success last year with our Valentine's Day episode. What was that topic again, Cam?
That was when Star Trek gets sexy.
And did it?
Oh, yes.
So much so that we had lots of bloopers from that one. Go back and listen to our best of 2015 to hear the bloopers.
It was 5 oh my's out of 5.
But I think this is a fun one because, Cam, you look, and I alluded to it earlier, you know, you look at kind of the history of romance in Star Trek, it's kind of sad.
Yeah.
And
weird.
Weird.
Yeah.
And even just kind of like, it almost seems as if these characters are very asexual.
Right.
And so when you see any hints of that on screen, you're always like, huh.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. I'm just going to jump into it with one
of
the weirdest romances. I never thought I would rewatch this episode so soon. It's been 22 years.
Okay.
This is one Dr. Beverly Crusher and her candle known as Ronin. This is from the episode Sub Rosa. I can't believe I actually rewatched this episode this evening.
Yeah.
That is, Cam, I had such horrible, traumatic thoughts about this episode going into it. This is just like amazing, as in like, wow, we need to watch this, do like some sort of live commentary. I was so entertained, just laughing my ass off this whole time.
Yeah.
Essentially, for those that don't remember, Crusher goes back and attends her grandmother's funeral on a planet that's based on Scotland.
That's very original series.
It is, yeah. That's interesting. Anyway, she encounters a candle that she lights up, and this anamorphic energy being corporealizes and swoops her off her feet to the point where she quits Starfleet to go live with him on this planets.
Isn't it like our grandmother's lover?
Yes, it is.
So wrong.
And great-grandmother's lover and great-great-grandmother's lover, this entity, Ronin, has followed the Howard women for years and years. So much so that Beverly's grandmother's been keeping a journal about her erotic exploits with this.
Would there be anything you would want to do less than read your grandmother's journal of erotic exploits?
Not much. But it's interesting you bring that up because at a certain point, Crusher even says to Troy, "I was reading a particularly erotic chapter when I fell asleep."
It reminds me of that scene from Titanic where, like, you know, you have the whole scene of him drawing Kate Winslet in the nude and it cuts back to Gloria Stewart. She's like, "It was the most erotic moment of my entire life."
You're like, and you know what? Hey, old people deserve to have sex, you know? Just, I
don't know that that's true.
I don't know. I'm just saying, maybe I'm a prude, but I just don't want to think about it at all. Mm-hmm. Captain Picard doesn't mind thinking about it because when Beverly Crusher's explaining that her grandmother was having, her 100-year-old grandmother was having a romance with a man in his 30s, Picard said, "The Howard women have exceptional libidos."
I was just like,
wow. Good on you, Jean-Luc. Cam, your reaction to Sub Rosa and Crusher's romance with this candle. Was it weird for you?
No, it wasn't weird. No, I just remember being... This was an episode that was very infamous. And I remember listening to, I think, another podcast where they were kind of laughing about this episode. So I definitely was looking forward to seeing it, to experiencing the wonder of Sub Rosa. But I remember when I watched it, I was bored out of my mind watching it.
See, I was not bored at all watching
this.
Really? Yeah, I was, like, beside myself, just entertained so much. After, you know, as a kid, I was bored out of my mind.
Right.
But, you know, I've matured into, you know, an exceptional young man.
Sure.
So, you know, unlike some other co-hosts. But, I don't know, I found this episode so amazing. Here's the thing, like, it does have that trope that kind of bugs me, where it's like a crew member is being influenced by another entity and they don't really have that much control over themselves.
Yeah.
I can forgive it if we get zombie grandma bursting out of her coffin and shooting electricity beams at Data and Geordi any day of the week. To me, like, that moment just sealed it. This is like, you know, I need to include this on our next list of hidden gems, Cam.
Oh, God. What do you think was the thinking when they saw the read the script for this episode?
You know what? I brought up Ron Moore's Outlander series, which people have kind of called like a bodice ripper. I think they just wanted to do another bodice ripper. Kind of a turn of the screw, sort of gothic lit sort of.
Does this fit into Next Generation?
No, not at all. This does not seem like a Next Gen
episode.
This
would work, I think, in the original series.
Yeah, I would buy it. I could even buy it as a Voyager episode for whatever weird reason. Hey, if they're in the Delta Quadrant and they come across a Scottish planet,
there's also a precedent for it because of Janeway's obsession with Jane Eyre.
Yeah.
Like that, the concept of like gothic romance is very much tied into Janeway's character. So I think that would work maybe better, but Crusher... Correct me if I'm wrong, but we've never gotten any hints of anything to, like, any interest in that sort of thing.
No. I mean, this is also the first time they've ever referenced her being Scottish as well. Which, I mean, I don't know, it's not...
I think
not,
you're supposed to assume that from the red hair,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, it's not a super shock, but I mean, still. It just seemed like such a bizarre, weird romance. Here's the question, as I've been going through lists, like, compiling the weirdest romance of Star Trek.
Yeah.
What I always ask is, what are people getting out of the relationship?
Right.
With this one, I actually do see what the two people are getting out of the relationship. Ronan, he wants to simply just keep surviving by using molecular life forms to sustain himself.
Right.
Crusher's getting a whole lot of sex. Like, there's just so many allusions to masturbation throughout this episode.
Yeah.
You just kind of see how sexually deprived these main characters are throughout the show. There'd be other characters that I'm bringing up. So, Cameron, any sexually deprived or depraved characters on your list?
Oh, there's so many on my list. Which one to start? You know what? We've just watched or talked about an episode that's maybe not considered so good. Let's talk about a good one.
Says you.
I want to talk about an episode of the original series called Metamorphosis.
Yes.
This is the episode where Kirk, McCoy, and Spock are kind of sucked onto this planet from space. They're escorting a Federation commissioner who's very gravely ill. They need to get her back to the Enterprise to cure her, but they wind up on this planet where Zefram Cochrane has been there for 150 years, and they discover that he's sort of been kept alive and protected by this gaseous energy something, cloud, that he calls the Companion. And what we find out sort of over the course of this episode is that there is almost like a romance going on between, at least from the Companion's point of view.
At least, certainly from the Companion's point of view.
Cochrane seems a little disturbed when he finds out.
Well, McCoy says, "You're a lover." Cochrane's,
"Yeah."
"I'm a what?"
Yeah.
He's been on this planet 150 years. He never sussed out that maybe this Companion had some feelings for him?
I don't know. Like, I think this is a really interesting episode. I think this might be the most unabashedly romantic Star Trek episode ever.
Hmm?
And I think it's actually really ahead of its time. It's obviously falls victim to the time it was made, because I think this is very much a metaphor for whether it is a gay love or something else. Because there's a scene where Cochrane is repulsed at the concept that he could have a relationship with the Companion. And Spock is like, "I don't understand. Like, why would this be a big deal?
Yeah.
You know, you both, you know, depend on each other. Like, why would you fight this?" And it's you know, ultimately, you know, the being has to take sort of the human form of the Commissioner who dies. And of course, you know, she's a very attractive young woman, which kind of gives it the sort of the heterosexual vibe at the end that, of course, Cochrane can be with this, you know, beautiful young woman. You know, this is the norm. But it's also 1966 or 67 television.
Yeah.
So this would be, I think, very provocative at the time, but you would have to mask it.
But I'm curious, like, what if the Commissioner wasn't a beautiful young woman, though?
Right.
Like, how do you think this episode would have played out?
I don't know.
Just hypothetically.
I mean, I don't think the episode would exist.
No, yeah, I agree. But, like, let's...
It looked like Pulaski in that episode where she got really old.
You know, but because I was having the same thought process of, like, how potentially provocative it could be, and I'm going based on, like, Spock's reaction to all of this. I don't know if that was intentional on the part of the writers. I think it was actually very unintentional, because I think
you're...
Yeah, I mean, these are, let's be honest, these are 1960s World War II vets that are penning these episodes.
This was written by Gene Kuhn, though, who was very progressive in the episodes that he wrote.
Yeah.
Like, he was very much, like, fascinated with, like, using sci-fi as a metaphor to explore things. So I could see that.
But do you think he was trying to make it, like, a metaphor for, like, non-heterosexual relationships, or the possibility?
I don't know, or just... Because you think this is falling in, like, the 60s free love period?
Yeah.
Just being open to things, I think, maybe.
And I guess maybe I was only saying that because I know Gene Roddenberry, he did a interview talking about how his own views on homosexuality changed over the decades.
Yeah.
I don't think Gene Roddenberry was, you know, going around making, like, pro-gay episodes.
No, I don't think so either.
So, and you know what, I'll defer to you when it comes to Gene Kuhn, because I don't know as much about him. I know that he was essentially the number two guy on the original series.
Yeah.
But I don't know, I am intrigued by that idea. I still might think that it was almost an unintentional thing. That's why I like sci-fi, because you can leave so much to interpretation,
right.
Though.
Yeah.
But what makes this... Okay, well, weirdest romance, what makes this so weird to you, Cam?
Well,
a gaseous cloud?
The gaseous cloud aspect, you know, obviously, is what makes it especially weird.
Okay.
And then he spent 150 years without realizing that this gaseous cloud is in love with him. But I love, you know, there's a scene where Kirk is seeing the two of them kind of joined, and he says, "It's love." And obviously, what he's really saying is it's, you know, lovemaking or sex or whatever. It's something very intimate.
Yeah.
They're not going to say that in 60s television. But it really makes this episode, I think, fascinating to read into. But also, is this the most adventurous episode Star Trek has about sort of tackling sex and love?
I would say you can make that argument for the original series. And going into the kind of the next gen era,
yeah.
As I've said before, they're really prudish when it comes to
Yeah.
So I think, honestly, okay, well...
There is the episode where Jadzia meets the former lover.
Rejoined.
I think I think that is a good example of one.
It is. I remember that, you know, generated a lot of talk at the time, you know. But you go back and watch that episode nowadays, and here's what kind of bugs me, though, is that they made it almost a plot point.
Yeah.
The reason I'm excited about, like, maybe Brian Fuller, like, you know, introducing, like, LGBTQ characters onto Star Trek is I don't think it's going to be there for plot point.
Right.
He's had those characters in his other series.
Yeah.
And they're just gay. It's not, like, a big deal. It's just that's who they are.
Right.
So that's why I kind of rejoined going back nowadays. You know, it just seemed like, oh, yeah, we have, like, two very attractive women make out. That's a very easy thing to sell. What if it was, like, two less attractive dudes like getting that on? I think that would have been a much tougher sell at the time. But it is still, if that's the second most kind of provocative thing that Star Trek has done in terms of sexuality, that's kind of sad. You know? I mean, there's other stuff that we've seen, like Riker with the episode The Outcast, you know?
Yep.
That's intriguing. I think it's probably the best example Next Gen has ever done with tackling sexuality.
Right.
But, I mean, I wouldn't classify Rejoined or The Outcast as episodes as weird romances. Those ones work for me.
Right.
Whereas this Gaseous Cloud, I do agree. It's kind of weird to be getting it on with a Gaseous Cloud.
And what makes it ultimately weird to me is, of course, that it takes over the body of the deceased Federation Commissioner.
How convenient.
Yes,
I mean. The very hot
very attractive
assistant
woman,
Federation Commissioner.
But I do love, there's that moment where she has the scarf and she holds it up in front of her eyes. And it's like seeing sort of through the energy cloud or whatever.
I really love that shot. And I think you and I have talked about our desire to do an episode in the future tackling, you know, directors of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Just like Star Trek, like I said before, it kind of got a little sterile towards you know, the Next Gen era, but there's still some very beautiful direction going on throughout the series. And that moment, that was my favorite shot of the entire episode. It just really sucked me in.
I really, you know, one of the great joys of this podcast has been going back and rewatching original series episodes for me.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I sat mesmerized by this hour of television. Just like, so, like, absolutely fell for this episode all over again.
Well, one of the joys of doing this podcast is you telling me what great episodes of TOS to go back and rewatch. I'm very fearful, like, you'll have gotten me through all the good ones, and all I'll have left are, like, really crappy episodes.
No, there's a lot of good.
Okay.
A lot of good.
Okay.
And even the bad, which I will get to a bad one later in this episode, even that was entertaining.
Okay. Well, next up for me, I don't know anybody who could not think of this as really, really weird.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to call them Salamander Janeway and Salamander Tom Paris getting it on and having salamander babies.
Yeah.
Cam, we watched Thresholds maybe a year ago for our weirdest transformations.
I actually watch it every week.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. You quote it to me via text message. And
that's right.
Like, leave me alone, sir. Leave your weird romances for your iPhone. But you know, I just remember watching this as a kid, and the thing that made me angriest was that they just left the salamander babies behind. I'm like, don't you care about your own offspring?
All they needed was one line of dialogue about how these things basically raise themselves.
Yeah, sure.
And no one would ever blink. It's the fact that it's never mentioned.
And they just, like, dump these, like, babies, like, on this planet.
You need that one line of exposition to save it all.
Here's the thing.
Well, not save it all, but to make it less offensive.
Sure. Here's, like, people mate, the idea, procreation, that's just kind of this evolutionary thing that goes on. So if Janeway and Tom Paris are salamanders, they're the only ones of their species, I can understand why they get it on.
Yeah.
But this episode kind of rubbed me the wrong way with, like, those two getting it on, and they just had an awkward conversation at sickbay together.
Well, it's also very rapey, because Janeway is taken against her will.
Yes.
And transformed after that.
Yes.
So it's not like this was something she was really looking to do.
It's him turning her into a mate that would work for him.
Yes.
It's kind of, nasty and weird, for sure.
You know, if Tom is taking this test drive with one of the Delaney sisters, and the two of them both mutate and then have salamander babies, we don't blink an eye.
Sure.
But in the Janeway case, it's weird.
Yeah, because he's specifically targeting the captain for this
escapade,
so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't know. Weird to me. Cam, what's next up on your list here?
Next up on my list, let's talk, you know, while we're talking about Voyager.
Sure.
Let's take a trip to Fairhaven.
Okay. How dare you? Molly the Cow isn't a weird romance for Harry Kim.
I call that a weekend.
Well, we're not in New Zealand. What are you talking about, man?
It's Sorry, New Zealand listeners, that's not my joke. No, I want to talk about Janeway's relationship with Michael Sullivan.
Mm.
Now, Michael Sullivan, of course, is the pub owner who has a, you know, wife named Franny and I believe children. And then Janeway rewrites his program to make him, essentially over a period of time, the perfect man.
She makes him taller. Does she give him a 5 o'clock shadow?
I think so.
Yeah. Makes him smarter.
Of course.
Yes, this is very creepy romance going on. It's essentially kind of going to the, hey, this seems like an intriguing dude.
Yeah.
Let's make him perfect for companionship.
Right.
And it kind of irks me that why can't she just get it on with, like, somebody she has, you know, chemistry with, such as, right. You'll be shocked, Chakotay.
I would be down for that.
Yeah. Like that.
Why would I? No, but there's the episode where they crash land together.
Yeah. That life support? Or no, I'm sorry. That's another very special episode of Star Trek we may discuss later on. The episode that they crash land together and they set up their own life together.
Yeah.
And then the writer's like, yeah, we're never touching upon that ever again.
Yeah, like that's a compelling idea. Michael Sullivan, not so much.
No.
Now, you know, we talked in Metamorphosis, you know, about what that could represent. I mean, is Fairhaven, God help it, sort of a cautionary tale about what happens when you try to change someone to become what you want? Is it a clumsy one at that?
I would say possibly, because would you actually be satisfied by this relationship if you can just keep changing the person to fit whatever parameters you set out?
Probably not.
It'd be deeply unsatisfying. I just find it so creepy, you know. Maybe we'll touch upon this later on with other holographic relationships.
But, we can only hope.
Yeah, I just find it really... It makes me think, okay, hey, I realize Janeway, if she is not going to get it on with any of her crew members, she's going to stand by that Starfleet policy, even though they're on this 75-year voyage home.
Mm-hmm.
Then what are her options? So I can kind of wrap my head around it, but it's just kind of like... It feels ultimately empty on her part. Like, if she's condemning herself to a life of loneliness, I feel kind of sad. And this is maybe why this romance seems just so weird to me.
And the episode doesn't have any sort of heaviness to it. It's a very light episode.
Yeah.
So you don't walk away with that feeling of, you know, really feeling one way or the other about what the message of the episode is. Like, Metamorphosis leaves you feeling something. This one is kind of just like, sure. Whatever, end program.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Here's a Cam fanfiction moment.
Oh, dear.
According to the novel Homecoming, which takes place after Voyager arrives home, Janeway made one last visit to Michael Sullivan before departing Voyager.
And how did that go?
In the visit, he expressed jubilation that they had returned.
Oh, and you're back, Katie.
And wished her good luck. She then deactivated him for the last time.
Yeah, listeners, you can't see it, but I'm fanning myself right now. That is what I call a bodice ripper.
That's right. Do you think, now Voyager, you know, this episode lands in like season 4, right, Fairhaven?
I think maybe season 5 or 6, perhaps.
Okay.
5 or 6.
So I guess it's not that much longer till they get back.
Sure.
Because if it was like, it landed like season 2, so there's then like 5 more years, do you think she's still going back to see Michael Sullivan?
You know, this is Cam fiction, so you Cam fiction writers can write whatever you want. Exactly. It doesn't really matter to me.
Done and done.
Well, you know what? Why don't we stay on track with holograms? I don't know. Anything weirder among Geordi LaForge relationships than him and
you
Dr. Leah
right
Brand? Well, here's the thing. I did debate because he had a couple really weird-ass relationships. Yeah. I debated whether Aquiel relationship was weirder than Leah Brahms. Here's a guy who's just into Aquiel. I don't know why. She's an incompetent officer. He's trying to like get her promotions by the end of it. That episode creeped me out with their telepathic sex toy.
Yeah.
But I still go back to the awkwardness of the holographic Leah Brahms and the...
In Booby Trap, yeah.
Yes. And then in Galaxy's Child, the follow-up where she discovers it. Cam, I don't think there's anything more awkward than the whole Leah Brahms relationship with Geordi. I don't know. What's your take here?
No, I agree. And I think what frustrates me the most about it is that... It is, you know, we talk about in the Psychology of Geordi LaForge episode a lot about that episode. So check that one out if you haven't listened to it already. But it's so uncomfortable and pervy. But there's really no punishment for it. Like, there's no there's no sense when we get to Galaxy's Child. Yes, Leah Brahms is angry and whatever, but ultimately he turns it on her.
Yeah.
And, you know, while this never happened, the show was going to essentially, or the creators were essentially going to reward this by having them be married at the Riker-Troy, you know, wedding. Or together, at least.
Well, and even in All Good Things, they are married in that alternate timeline.
That's right, yeah. So it doesn't even see this as like, you know, we could talk about whether Fairhaven is a cautionary tale for Janeway. I don't think Booby Trap is a cautionary tale for Geordi. And neither is Galaxy's Child, because he's ultimately rewarded for what is, frankly, a little disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, by the end of it, they're friends at the end of Galaxy's Child. They're laughing together in 10 Forward.
Yeah.
Moments earlier, she's discovering this holographic version of herself, and she's saying, "Was it good for you?"
Yeah.
She is pissed off. And I think with all, you know, just she's completely justified in feeling that way.
Yeah.
And just that whole confrontation was so uncomfortable to watch.
Yeah.
I don't know. And Cam, we discussed it, you know, pretty much in depth in our Holodeck Hookups episode.
Mm-hmm.
It crept us out unbelievably.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of moral implications that aren't really dealt with at all in this instance. It's just really uncomfortable. I mean, could you be friends with someone who had made a holographic sex program of you?
Well, I'm friends with two. so, I guess, yes.
Leave former Fallen co-host Benjamin Young out of this.
He said it was just between you and him.
Booby Trap is a pretty good episode. Can we agree on that?
Yeah.
And you know what? Even Galaxy's Child is at least entertaining. It's not a good episode, but it is entertaining.
Like, hey, Geordi's wearing hammer pants.
You know, we've revisited some really terrible episodes for this podcast. Galaxy's Child is not one that was painful to sit through.
No, no.
So, I mean, I don't think it was two terrible episodes or anything. I just think that
it really made you think less of Geordi LaForge.
Yes.
And if that, here's the thing. The reason writers introduce romances to characters is I think they want to add more depth to the characters.
Right.
This really makes you think less of Geordi by the end.
It added depth, though.
Yeah.
In the sense you wondered how like low he could go.
Yes.
and also how shallow he ultimately is.
Essentially, like, what is it that draws him in to Dr. Leah Brahms? Is it her looks or her knowledge of the spaceship? Either way, it's not really personality-based, right?
No.
So, and then when he finally meets her, I don't know. I've just think about how many times he must have studied her personnel records and kept maybe subconsciously missing the fact that she's a married woman.
Yeah.
Very, very
disturbing. That is really actually difficult to miss considering the amount of records he would have gone through.
Yes.
To create a program that like mirrors someone's personality or whatever and all the information he would need, that seems like what, like, you search anyone on the internet, it's like one of the first things that's going to come up.
Yeah, if
I'm
you're
thinking
like,
of like IMDb, that's like right there on the right side of the screen.
Or even just like creeping on someone's Facebook page.
Right.
Like, it's going to be pretty obvious if they're married.
I mean, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. There you go.
You speak from experience.
That's how I figured out that you were single, Cam.
Oh my.
Well, Cam, so I'm curious, what's your next pick here?
Okay, let's go to Deep Space Nine.
Yes.
And let's talk about Quark and his ex-wife, Grokka.
Really? Okay, I'm going to make an argument against why this is not a weird relationship.
Okay.
But you argue why.
Well, first off, most romances don't start as a marriage of convenience.
Okay.
So that part's a little strange.
Sure, sure.
But, you know, where I'm really taking most of my research is from the episode Looking for Par Mach in All the Wrong Places.
Yes, you do.
Now, this is the episode where she comes back to the station and he's smitten. But ultimately, he needs to kind of fight for her love in a Bat'leth battle with her bodyguard.
That's an amazing sequence, by the way.
Also weird. I don't know where you're getting the normal from this. In which case, he needs to turn himself into a human robot and be controlled by Worf throughout the battle to win her hand. Again, does this seem normal to you?
That's how I met my girlfriend.
You were like a puppet?
Yeah. I was like Geppetto.
Also, this, you know, of course, does the famous, you know, Cyrano de Bergerac storyline for Quark, with Worf giving advice. And I really like this aspect of, like, Worf really having the hots for Quark's wife.
Are you sure it's Cyrano de Bergerac or Roxanne starring one Steve Martin?
That too.
Okay.
Yes. And that's sort of a fun idea. But my question to you is, this whole, you know, concept, which goes back in literature many, many, many years ago, hundreds of years ago, really, would this ever work in reality?
Well, it's science fiction, Cam, not science fact.
Well.
Okay. You pose a good question.
Are you still defending this as normal?
I'm not saying it's normal, but it's not one that strikes me as weird.
And it ends in the infirmary with multiple fractures.
Here's what I mentioned earlier. It's like, I'm going through all these lists and I'm saying, do I understand what each party's are getting out of this?
Right.
And does it make sense to me? But here's the thing. I think these characters kind of have a chemistry with one another.
Sure.
I understand what the other one gets out of this relationship. To me, this relationship makes sense. It doesn't make my skin crawl.
I'm not saying that.
All the other relationships that I'm listing here, they all make my skin crawl to a certain degree.
The reason I include is the weird, is the sort of the hoops that have to be jumped through for this relationship to continue.
Fair
are
enough.
All very strange.
Yeah, okay. Well, I can't disagree with that. I thought, you know, some people would have wanted this one on their list. And the reason why is because people look at funny looking aliens and they're like, oh, they're kind of like repulsive looking. That's weird.
Right.
That's off-putting. Well, here's the next Deep Space Nine couple that I'm going to bring up here. And I think there could be parallels, not necessarily in looks department, but in what's beneath the skin here.
Right.
I'm talking about one Kai Winn and Gul Dukat. I'm letting you know when...
I don't see anything wrong with this one.
When we find out that the two most repulsive characters...
Yes.
And I'm talking about what's been below the surface here, started hooking up, getting in the sack together... I was just like, oh my god. Like, that was frightening to me.
I'll be in my bunk.
I mean, to me, it was an amazing pairing just to see how utterly disgusted Wynn was once she discovered Anjul's true identity.
Right.
But I mean, Cam, does this weird relationship work for you?
This one...
It's a weird relationship, correct?
I mean, it's very much driven by two people who are basically psychotic, or at least sociopathic. So I can believe that they would be drawn to each other in a weird way. So you know what? This one, actually, I didn't really even think of including my weirdest romances because...
It all looks so normal to you as they're feeding berries to each other in bed?
I guess it's weird in the sense of these two characters... Because they're both so, in themselves, so odd.
Oh, yeah.
But I can buy the two of them getting together.
And the reason I include them on the list, because I agree, I buy the two of them getting together, even under false pretenses.
Yeah.
She thinks Angel's just a simple farmer who the prophets are speaking to. The reason it's weird is because these are just such repulsive characters. They're the worst of the worst. It makes my skin crawl.
It definitely makes my skin crawl.
And that's why I had to include it, because it just had that, I had that visceral reaction where I just sucked in my stomach and was just like, ugh.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on
here? It was definitely a visual. And it was definitely an image that we kind of texted back and forth. Was like,
I think,
the two of them together.
Was it when Fallen co-host Benjamin Yong first watched that episode?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
We texted him the image or whatever.
I think he was horrified by the two of them getting it on. But
yeah, like, I mean, the Quark-Grokka relationship, it makes me cringe in no way or shape or form.
No.
It's more just to me, like, the whole circumstances are bizarre.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's also the episode where Worf and Dax get together. And what kind of surprised me was when I went to revisit this episode, I was focusing more on Quark and Grokka. But the relationship between Worf and Jadzia actually really comes out of nowhere. In a way that I did not remember. I remember feeling much more built up to.
That's what I always thought.
No, it's like a really bizarre twist where he's obsessed with Grokka for like 30 minutes of the episode.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And then she like jumps him in the holosuite. And then it just goes from there and then cuts to basically them in the infirmary.
Right. Yeah.
And so it really did feel kind of out of nowhere, which in itself was weird.
But I mean, and here's the thing, I'm not including Dax and Worf on my list. I don't think you are either, because
not at all.
This is not a weird relationship.
No, it has a weird start, though, I guess.
Yeah, but this particular relelationship, other people might put it on their lists. I would argue it works.
You know,
and it totally makes sense why these characters would be together. So,
yeah.
But it's intriguing what you discover rewatching, doing research for this. There's another episode that I'll bring up later on where there's a subplot going on that was simply amazing and horrifying at the same time.
Okay, well, I'm looking forward to that. But I have one more cam fiction moment.
Yes.
And this is relating to Groka. I was really curious whatever happened to her, because the episode ends with her and Quark kind of... Yeah, I was. Because this episode ends with her and Quark kind of together and whatever, and then she's never mentioned really again, or it's never appears again on the show.
Okay.
And it's just interesting that they would kind of set up a romance for Quark that doesn't kind of have an end point.
You figure maybe she could have been doing something during the Dominion War, or...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Just, you could pay off that character in some way. So I was like, I did some research on her, because I was curious if she was ever mentioned in any of the novels or anything like that. And she was mentioned, actually, in Star Trek Online.
Ooh.
That Groka married Worf.
Really?
Yes.
So I guess he ended up getting her in the end.
Yes.
Okay. Well, good for those two kids. I'm happy for them, I guess.
That one kind of took me back. I did not expect that.
Yeah. Well, good thing it's non-canon.
Well, true enough. I don't know. Is Star Trek Online canon? I don't know.
Non-canon.
Is it? Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'm afraid not. Okay, well, you know what? We've been going a little easy on Voyager so far.
Have we?
Let's get to the meat and potatoes here. Kes and Neelix, Cam.
That's on my list.
Beyond the fact that there's zero chemistry between these two actors, let's just talk about the very notion of a 40-something-year-old alien dating a 1-year-old.
Yeah.
Like, that whole thing just was creepy from the get-go. And we had a friend of the podcast, Jera Hodge, on. She just talked about how disturbing his whole persona as, like, this jealous parental figure was. You know, like, Tom Paris gives her his seat.
Yeah.
And Neelix is pissed off.
Yeah. I really thought a lot about this relationship this week, which, frankly, is the saddest thing I've ever said in my life.
It is Valentine's coming up.
That's true. That's true. I'll be thinking of them. This relationship is really only has jealousy fueling it from a creative standpoint.
Yes.
Like, there is nothing going on in this relationship. That, you know, it's basically just like him being kind of jealous and then her forgiving him, or him saying, oh, I've learned a lesson, and not learning a lesson. It's almost like the writers didn't know how to write a relationship at all. So they created a lot of false drama to try and make it interesting. It reminded me a lot of the Spider-Man problem. This was in the 90s, Spider-Man, or I guess it was the late 80s, Spider-Man and Mary Jane, Peter Parker and Mary Jane, got married in the comics. And for the next, like, decade plus, the writers really struggled with how to write a married couple. Right. It got to the point where it became an editorial, like, mandate that they had to somehow break them up. And they had the devil interfere and dissolve the marriage. It was terrible. I mean, they lost a lot of readers at that point.
Right.
But it was essentially like the writers were not able to write a relationship. They needed Spider-Man to be single.
You're telling me that comic book writers aren't all that familiar with the proper marital, you know, relationships?
It would seem.
Wow.
And I think, you know, that might have been the case with some of the Voyager writers. Because it's the same problem. It's like they have no interest in writing a functional relationship. Look at Dax and Worf.
Well, here's the interesting. Dax and Worf, they have conflict.
Yes.
But, like, it's not like they're miserable, miserable married couple or anything like that.
Like the O'Briens.
Yes. But
at least there's an attempt with the O'Briens to try and write a family.
Yeah.
We can question or quibble about how it was done, but there is an attempt. Like, the Neelix casting is never even... They don't even really attempt it.
The closest that we come to them really addressing the intimacy of this relationship is in Tuvix.
Yeah.
And she has to kind of come to grips with losing Neelix and then deciding whether she wants to continue on a relationship with Tuvix.
Yeah.
Tuvix wants to pursue that. Kes is just like, I can't do that with you, but I'm ready to be friends now.
Yeah.
And the whole time I'm watching this is like, I don't buy for a second that Kes really cares about Neelix, you know, more than she would care about, say, Harry Kim.
Right.
It's just kind of like, eh, really? Like, why are those two together? And they break them up. when she is possessed by the consciousness of an alien
named Tyrion,
and after Tyrion leaves her body, she doesn't get back together with Neelix.
Yeah, and it's not even acknowledged.
No,
it's just like they break up in that episode when she's possessed, and then it's never again acknowledged. Like, that's when you can tell they just don't care.
It's just, well, they knew that they failed miserably with that relationship,
and I think there was at least something interesting that they could have mined. And I don't think this was in any way intentional, but more the concept of dating someone with a huge age difference. You know, because the sense that Neelix would be so jealous, like, you can buy that an older, say, man would be jealous of dating a younger woman who maybe has a more open social life. Like, you can understand how that would cause, like, this weird kind of almost overprotectiveness. But I don't think any of this was intentional. I think it's more like, it's more just like, that's all you're left with.
I keep going back to my time spent. I used to work in a developing country where there are a lot of expats from the U.S. Who are in like their 60s, 70s, very gross-looking dudes that would go there and marry beautiful young brides.
Right.
And just pretty much force them to stay in their homes, you know, cook for them. It was very creepy and disturbing.
Yeah.
So even if you wanted to mine that with Neelix, I still think it comes down to this very disturbing kind of parental relationship where, I guess, like...
She's the more mature one, though, to be fair. Yeah. Kes is definitely the more mature one in the relationship.
I agree.
But it still has that, yeah, that weird sort of, I need to be in control sort of thing going on his end.
But, Cam, was there any real... evidence of any intimacy between those two?
Thank God, no.
Not necessarily just physical intimacy, but like, you know, like just kind of that emotional intimacy. I never got that sense, though.
No, it was more like affectionate, like the way you would treat a puppy.
Yeah, you know, like, well, she does have the cool ears that he would like to rub, so there you go. And he has the whiskers that, you know, she would love to pet, so...
Yeah, when we talk about Star Trek being very frigid, like, their relationship was very frigid.
Yeah. And that's one of the most loving relationships in Star Trek. Oh, Star Trek.
Yeah.
Your weird romances.
Not well done at all. No.
Cam, what's next on your list?
Well, let's go, you know, speaking of not well done at all, you know, I knew I had to find a weird Kirk relationship, because Lord knows Kirk had his share of oddball relationships in the original series. And so I want to talk about an original series episode called Requiem for Methuselah.
Methuselah. I'm sure that'll end well.
This is not a great episode at all.
I'm glad you didn't ask me to watch this one as well.
So, okay, so what the episode is about is Kirk, Spock, and Bones beam down to this planet, and they're searching for Rigelane, which is like an organic compound that can be used to create a cure for the Rigelian fever, which people on the ship are getting. And they're down there, and they discover this old man named Flint. He's very wise, very intelligent. He has sort of a robot helper, kind of like a floating R2-D2, or actually looks more like Nomad from The Ultimate Computer. But, you know, he's very smart, and he goes brings them back to his place. And he's got, like, all this artwork that seems to be Da Vinci's. And he's playing music that's, you know, could be Brahms. And it turns out that ultimately he's sort of like an immortal being. He's been around for thousands of years. He was Da Vinci. He was Brahms. He was Lazarus. He was all these different figures. But...
Banksy? Was he Banksy?
He didn't reference Banksy, but probably yes.
Okay. I'm going to believe it's Banksy.
At a certain point, he introduces his adopted daughter, Raina, who we've seen sort of behind the scenes that he's very interested. Old Flint is very interested in young 20-something Raina. And, you know, she's a blonde, very beautiful woman. Looks a little like Olivia Dabo from The Wonder Years. And also...
And Star Trek The Next Generation.
Of course, episode Q, yes. I go to Wonder Years. That's my go-to. Anyways, it seems like Flint, just, you know, she kind of shoots him down. So he's really trying to pair her off with Kirk. And Kirk falls in love hardcore within an hour. Like, he is ready. He's, like, endangering the mission for this woman. He is obsessed with her.
Now, is this through his own volition? So he's not under the influence of anything?
Okay. There are no pheromones. There's no alien drugs. There's nothing going on.
There's no candles?
Nope. He is just in love. It comes out that Raina is an android. And she's been created by Flint to basically be his companion.
They sure like those companions in the original series.
Yeah, let's be honest, sex robot is what he wants. But she's not interested in him. So he's trying to get Kirk to warm her up for him.
Oh, God.
and sort of get her hot and bothered and then leave her with him and she will learn to love. So awful.
Season three?
This is season three.
Okay.
And the whole thing is, it's like, it's one thing if, like, so what ultimately happens is she is sort of develops full consciousness and understands what love is. And she's divided between sort of her loyalties to Flint and her great love for Kirk. And she ends up dropping dead.
Which happens.
Yeah, it happens. But Kirk is so broken about this. He is distraught. Like, frankly, he should be on stress leave or put under a counselor. Because he's back in the Enterprise. He's got his, like, head in his hands. And he's just like, I wish I could forget. I wish I could forget. And Spock uses the Vulcan mind wipe and puts his hand to Kirk's head when he's asleep and goes, forget.
Oh, wow.
Nessa Reyna is erased from time.
Do you wish, after you viewed this episode, that Spock would come into your bedroom and do the Vulcan mind wipe on you while you slept?
Do I ever. Yeah. Do I ever. It was interesting, though. I read just a bit of an interview with the woman who played Reyna, who's Louise Sorrell, and she was a theater actress, a serious theater actress. And so was actually James Daly, who played Flint. And the two of them were kind of like, what are we doing on this show?
Yeah.
And she said all she kept saying to herself doing that episode was, Christmas money, Christmas money, Christmas money.
Yeah, I don't blame him.
She said, though, she loved working with Shatner. That was like one of the great highlights, was working with him. She said he was an absolute blast. But my God. And the thing is, like, this isn't even like young, hot Kirk. This is like Shatner when he kind of goes over the cliff real quick. Like, he's very pudgy at this point, and he's got a very visible toupee.
Okay.
And he keeps referring to himself in this episode as a young man. And you're like, not buying this. Right. So it's kind of this sweaty man in a toupee, and then this old 60-something-year-old fawning over this blonde 20-year-old woman. And at one point, like, they are, like, almost both of them in unison pleading on their knees for her. It's weird.
Wow. I believe it, Cam. It so sounds weird to me.
Requiem for Methuselah, everybody. That is weird.
I think instead of Threshold, you're going to be getting that on your weekly rotation from here on out.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what we're doing Valentine's Day night.
Just a marathon and repeat.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, I got to mention this one. It's not one that makes my skin crawl in the way the others do, but it really disturbed me. It's a weird relationship, mostly because it came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
That's Seven of Nine in Chakotay.
Yeah, I haven't seen this episode yet.
It's really the series finale that they actually get a real romance going on. It comes out of nowhere. Even Jerry Ryan and Robert Beltran both complained about it. Because here's the thing. They hinted at this romance in a later episode of season 7.
Right.
Seven of Nine's playing with her, or experimenting with her emotions in the episode Human Error. The next episode, the two are crash-landed on a planet, and the actors are asking the producers, so should we play it up as if, you know, we've had this sort of burgeoning romance going on or something? And the producers are like, no, don't play anything. Mm. You guys are just stranded on this planet. A couple of episodes later, it's a series finale. Seven of Nine is beaming into Chakotay's quarters, giving him flowers, and they're macking on each other. It just came out of nowhere. Like, it wasn't even really...
You think she thought he was a robot?
It's very possible.
Yeah.
But well, she's the robotic one because, like, she just starts, like, macking on him, and Chakotay's like, whoa, what was that about? And she's like, I hear it's always awkward giving the first kiss. And then Chakotay says, what about the second one? And then Seven says, I need to check my data banks. And then Chakotay just goes in for it and starts kissing her anyways. And it came out of nowhere, really. Even like Human Error, like she's just kind of experimenting with emotions on the holodeck, and she starts to kind of fall for Chakotay, and then it's just all forgotten about after that. And then suddenly they're like, okay, well, series finale, let's just wrap up everybody, pair them off where we can. I don't know, like, I would have been happier if, like, Harry Kim just came out of nowhere as, like, a relationship for Seven. Like,
so would Harry Kim.
No kidding. But I don't know, this just really bothered me. It didn't make my skin crawl the way some of these other relationships did, but it's just so unfulfilling and earned. It was not an earned relationship whatsoever.
What's with these Trek late in the game relationships? Like the Worf Deanna thing we've talked about in the past. I don't think either of us would consider that a weird relationship.
No, because that one works.
Yeah, though. It did work. The only problem is it's not really dealt with that interestingly.
And there's really no resolution to it after the series finale.
No, but again, it came out in like the last handful of episodes of TNG, and then now.
You know, I just think it's a common thing in the 90s, like. People know that their series is ending, so they need to just pair everyone up together.
Yeah.
You know? Like, you see that a lot in sitcoms back in the day. I think they're just doing it on Star Trek as well. I mean,
I guess props to Enterprise for not pulling that.
Yeah, well, sure.
Like, you know. Reed and Hoshi getting together in, like, the last episode.
But here's the thing. I don't think the T'Pol and Trip romance was ever weird. Like, it had the potential to be weird, but it worked for whatever reason, no matter the weird ass neuro pressure going on.
Isn't that the part that worked the most?
For me it did. Yeah. As well as those decon gel scenes.
All right.
But I mean, for whatever reason, it worked. I think it comes down to whether these actors have chemistry. Beltran and Mulgrew had chemistry.
Yeah.
I don't see any sparks flying between Jerry Ryan and Robert Beltran, though. It just didn't. And I could have seen it actually happen with Kim and Seven, you know, to a certain degree.
So could Harry Kim.
Yeah, I know. I don't know. This just was just so out of the blue.
Yeah.
And for them to put in the series finale, that's what made it weird and just unfulfilling to me.
Was it paid off in any sort of interesting way? Like when you get to the end of the episode or anything like that?
Not at all.
No?
Not at all.
Are they together at the end of the episode?
They're just kissing at the beginning. And can I be honest? Like, spoiler alert, this one also involves alternate timelines and stuff, so it's very...
Gee, that sounds a lot like another popular Star Trek show.
It's just, I guess you can lead yourself to believe that in the timeline that goes on after the credits close, after the closing credits, then the two of them may have pursued this relationship. But in the alternate timeline, it ultimately did not end well. Chakotay is dead. And we even visit his gravestone.
Oh, okay.
So there you go.
What's the difference between living and dead Chakotay?
Nothing in terms of charisma. You know.
The dead one's less stiff.
But Cam, I don't know. I feel as if there's one particular relationship we haven't touched upon that's very important to this podcast. Is it on your list? I'm curious.
I know the one you're talking about.
Okay.
And let's leave that to the end.
Okay.
I do have another one to mention.
Go for it.
And that is Picard and Kamala in the episode The Perfect Mate.
Oh, come on, Femke Janssen?
Yeah.
That's not weird to you?
Well,
it's again having like that. Oh, okay, I agree. This is a weird thing.
Yeah.
Because she's trying to, you know.
She's a gift.
Yeah.
Like, as a sort of a peace treaty between two warring factions, she's going to be the gift sent from one side to marry the other leader. And it turns out she's an empath who winds up on the Enterprise and is basically programmed from birth to be the perfect romantic companion. And she sets her sights on old Baldy.
She knows what to say and how to woo him.
Yeah.
And the whole thing just makes my skin crawl because this is not a real romance or relationship. It's so artificial. I think the episode is trying to emphasize that. They're not trying, like with these other romances.
Yeah.
They're trying to say, oh no, this is a normal romance.
Yeah.
This one, I don't think the series is projecting that at all.
Not normal, but the fact that she does bond with Picard.
Yeah.
For life.
Yeah.
And that's going to apparently stick. Because she ultimately marries someone else, but Picard will always be her true love or true companion or whatever you want to, soulmate, whatever you want to call it.
Just think about how this paid off, you know, in all the future episodes and seasons.
Yeah, this is like really kind of icky because it's like, it's almost like the Star Trek version of the girlfriend experience for much of it. but more from like a sadder point of view.
Are you talking about the Soderbergh?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But more from a sadder, even sadder point of view in the sense that like Kamala's life is terrible.
Yeah.
And is going to continue to be terrible.
And
Picard gets to go off to other great adventures.
I remember watching this and just feeling like utterly, utterly sorry for her.
Yeah.
And just like, this is like what she has left to look like. Can she escape somehow? Or if not, then this treaty's going to be through.
Yeah.
So really, what recourse does she have? Nothing.
Yeah, and it's like, all she really gets out of this is like, well, Picard has taught me about duty. you know what? Duty's going to last you maybe a week. You're looking at, you know, she's fairly young. So, I mean, what? Like, say she has a human, you know, comparison lifespan. She's got like 60 to 80 more years.
I'm curious, Cam. Does sense of duty among Star Trek main characters far outweigh the average viewer's sense of duty that they deal with in their day-to-day life?
I would say so. Yeah. By a lot.
It seems like half the episodes are concerned about, you know, the officer's duty.
Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah.
And that's, like, the lesson from this, is that essentially Picard taught, like, a sex slave about duty?
Yeah. It's weird.
It's really awkward and uncomfortable. Yeah. You know, so.
Well, yeah. Okay, Cam. I think there's really only one romance left to tackle now.
I think so.
I never thought I'd do it, but I went and rewatched Life Support. Just to see how the beautiful, beautiful relationship between one Major Kira Nerys and Vedic Brile Antos came to a crashing end.
Right.
Of course, this is the episode where Brile is injured on the eve of these important treaty negotiations. So he actually dies, and Bashir is able to revive him using like these experimental drugs. But slowly and surely, his organs start to fail, and he needs to get half his brain replaced by a positronic brain.
Which happens.
To me, frequently. Yeah. I love the end of this relationship, though.
What, that he dies?
Yes, of course. Here's the thing. Let's tackle it from the beginning. We've long kind of held that Brile, the character, doesn't have much punch to him. Would you agree with that?
He's a little milk toast, yeah.
And to pair him up with one of the punchiest characters,
yeah,
it really kind of like halted a lot of Kira's development, in my opinion.
Right.
It really made her character suffer. I don't think those two had any charisma. They seemed to enjoy spring ball. She didn't mind that he's really boring and into gardening.
Yeah.
Did you really get anything out of this relationship, Cam?
I got nothing out of it, but it's a relationship that I've spent far more time than any human being should do thinking about it. I understand why they paired them up. Because Kira is a character who's full of conflict and anger. He is calm, tranquil. I mean, he's the even keel one, right? Like, he's kind of what Kira needs. The problem is that Brile is such a blank slate of a character that it's unsatisfying. Like, I think... And same with Shakar. Shakar is the same problem.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because her next romance is with Shakar.
I think Shakar's worse than Brile. I'm going to go ahead and just say that straight up. I think he's even more boring. But I think Brile, the problem is that even though Star Trek has, I think, trouble sometimes writing characters who are a little more passive and not making them boring.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
And he is boring. He's not like a supportive love interest.
And you don't really care what Brile's up to next.
No, well, we know he's up to. He's standing in his garden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess the writers, they... We're realizing that this is what the Iris Stephen Bear said in interviews, that, you know, these relationships are supposed to show growth in characters, and they realize that Kira wasn't growing with this character at all, so let's kill him off.
Looking at Kira's relationship, because let's include Shakar in this equation too.
Sure.
Do you feel like these relationships, both Brile and Shakar, contributed to Kira in a way that would sort of pave the way for the Odo relationship? I don't think so.
No, and here's the thing. It makes me think less of Kira, that she would find these really boring-ass people worth her time. She just seems she could do so much better.
Yeah, she was slumming with both of them. Especially Shakar, I think.
Well, I don't... I
guess she had more in common with...
I think them, that's maybe? The thing. Like, with Shakar, I understand. I mean, they can bond. I mean, she was part of the Shakar resistance cell.
Right, true.
It makes sense to me from that angle. I agree. I mean, Shakar, I think, was only in three episodes until they broke up. So I can kind of get over the fact. I think the writers were like, okay, let's cut our losses, you know, with Shakar. We know it didn't work with Brile, didn't work with Shakar. Let's cut our losses. I don't think the writers ever really were interested in pursuing this Odo-Kira relationship until they realized, you know, this actually kind of might work.
Yeah.
It worked for me.
It worked really well for me, yeah.
But, I mean, with Brile, here's the thing. He dies.
Yes.
Kira's response.
Gloriously. Yeah.
She has a blank stare on her face, and she says, "Dr. Bashir, I'll be in ops." And Bashir's like, well, nobody expects you to be at ops right now. She's like, I need to be at ops. It's like, that's how she deals with her lover dying, is, you know, maybe she needs to bury herself in her work, but it's still a very, like, okay.
Yeah.
Then he dies a second time, and she talks about, like, the first time I saw you, you just had this aura about you. It's just like, really?
Aura of blame.
Yeah, no kidding. I don't think she cared one iota. Like, I think she actually thought he was really pompous, I believe, the first time that they
met. Well, she was weirded out when she had the vision of the two of them as lovers and everything. Yeah.
I was weirded out.
I wouldn't be weirded out.
Wait, are you in the Cure role or the Brielle role?
Does it matter?
No, not to me. But I don't know. This is just such a lame... I wish we could milk this more for laughs, but like, just this entire relationship was so boring, though. There's nothing there. Here's what the O'Briens... I mean, here's a relationship I thought was really dysfunctional. I wouldn't quite put it on my weirdest list, but... It's very clear that the two hated each other's guts. Miles quite enjoyed the company of Julian far more than his own wife.
I mean, he was kind of eyeing Kira, too, in the episode looking for Parmach.
Yeah.
In the wrong places, yeah.
I didn't believe for 1 minute that in the episode Fascination, when people had their subconscious feelings and attractions about other people's come out, that the O'Briens weren't attracted to anyone but each other. Yeah. But here's the thing, I can kind of...
Why do you question the purity of their love?
Well, I'm just saying, I can kind of get behind Star Trek doing a crotchety old married couple that really... Because some people get married and they don't even really like each other that much. Like, it happens.
Oh yeah, it happens a lot.
So why not do it on Star Trek, you know? It's not a great relationship, but is it weird? I wouldn't say it's weird. It's actually kind of normal.
Let's remember...
It's kind of normal.
Let's cut the O'Brien some slack. Because we are seeing them at sort of the period... where the most stress is placed on a relationship when you have young children.
Yeah.
So, you know, we've seen them get married in TNG.
No, okay. We see them get married in TNG after Keiko tells Data, hey, tell Miles I can't get married. Left him at the altar right then and there.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
And it's interesting because the very next episode, so that was Data's day.
Yeah.
And the very next episode is The Wounded. And they're having breakfast together for the very first time. And he's just poking at her Japanese food. He's like, what is this? You know, he's like, I need to serve you eggs and sausage. And she's poking at his food the next morning. She's like, what is this? He's like, it's capers. These people have been married a week and they already hate each other. It's just like, and it's very clear. Like, have they not spent any time with each other? They don't know what each other eats. They clearly, this is the first time they've moved in together.
Maybe that's kind of what makes the magic between them, is they like bickering.
I that must be it. Because there are those couples that all they do is fight, 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 but they can't help but get back together.
Yeah.
Maybe they're just destined to fight, and that's what makes them so attracted to each other.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I saw an old couple in a bakery recently, and the two of them were looking at dessert. And they'd obviously been married quite a long time. You know, they were in their 60s probably. I didn't get the vibe this was a recent relationship. He was like, really wanted to get chocolate cake, right? And she looked at him and said, you're not eating chocolate cake. And walks away. And he put his head down and just followed her.
See, that's just sad, sad
but is
misery.
That just the relationship? Like, is it functional because, like, it operates that way? Is that the way the O'Briens are?
You know, I'd like to think that the episode, The Assignments, where she's taken over by the Paw Wraiths, it's a meta commentary on their entire relationship where he views her as an evil, evil entity, forcing him to do things he doesn't want to do.
Don't you think he would be frustrating too, though? He's kind of schlumpy, kind of whatever.
I think he's also very emotionally aloof.
Yeah.
I really don't see him bearing a soul to her, which must be really, really tough for her. Remember when he set up a workshop in their bedroom while she was on Bajor, and she was offended by that? And I can understand why she would be. And I think it took Bashir to explain to Miles, oh, no, you're just showing more intimacy with her because being in the bedroom working on these little trinkets reminds you of her.
Right.
Miles, I think, said, I think I like you more than my wife. You know, it's just kind of like, it's just like... I don't know. I like how we're far more engaged and fascinated by, like, this horrible O'Brien marriage than we are by Blandy McBlanderson and Kira.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I think, you know, I don't know. Is there a weirder relationship than say, Brielle and Kira? Or is it just weird because Kira is such an awesome character and she's just with the most vanilla person possible?
I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, when I, you know, right from the start, I really fell hard for the Kira character. I thought she was just a fantastic character. And I would always, you know, look forward to seeing every episode what she would be up to. And then, you know, Vedic Brielle shows up. And he's a character that's easy to ignore because he doesn't really do anything interesting.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like, oh, yeah, yeah, whatever. And suddenly, once the romance starts, you're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
It takes you by surprise because you would think they would pair her up with someone much more dynamic. Someone, at least, who's interesting.
Well, it's interesting to look at Deep Space Nine as a whole when it comes to relationships. I think they're far and away the most successful
franchise. Is there another one that really strikes you as false? You can say, like, you know, that the O'Briens bicker and whatever, but does it strike you as false? The Kira Brielle one feels false.
Yeah, I agree. Because I'm thinking, look, you have Yates and Sisko. I think that's a great relationship. You have Lita and Rom.
Yeah.
I think that's great as well. Jadzia and Worf always works. Even, like, Ezri and Bashir makes sense to me.
That one I'm a little more on the fence about, but it's not one that I was willing to throw it as weird as romance.
Forever. No.
I just wasn't as crazy about it.
No, but just ringing false? No, I don't think any other relationship on Deep Space Nine does that. The one thing I do...
You told Jake in the Muse.
I will bring up Jake just now because there is this amazing subplot in Life Signs where Jake and Nog go on a double date, and I remember looking at it going, oh my god, Nog, what are you doing? It's like Nog's date is talking a lot.
Yeah.
And then, like, Nog essentially says, oh, Jake, won't this female just shut up? And then he shoves his plate at her and says, cut up my food for me. Make yourself useful.
Yeah.
Jake's just beside himself, embarrassed. And then he realizes by the end that Nog is actually trying to be on his best behavior. Nog's right. Like, no, I only asked her to cut up my food because on Frangenar, we get the women to chew their food, my food.
Right.
I'm just trying to, you know, like, meet you halfway there, Jake. I was just like, well, okay. Different cultures.
Yeah, sure.
But, I don't know. Cam?
I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. You can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Valentine, comma, be my Smith.
Wow. I thought you were going for Vedic, but no. You can find me at Reportin. That's REPORTON. N as in Neelix loves Kes. Right, guys? Right? Does Am he? I right? No? Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Welcome to my beautiful garden. What answers do you seek, my child?
Tell me, who is most righteous, Vedic Brielle?
I shall do better than tell you, my child. Brielle, 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 Vedic Brielle.
They call me
Brielle, Brielle.
First son of Ajor, arm run the major, prophet chosen player, stuff Cardassian in danger. Hot like a bout of the Xanthi fever, voices from the temple and off the receiver. Let me take your pot and make you a believer, Vedic to the people and never a deceiver. Cause like a flower's in my garden and my heart'll never harden. Step up on the spring before, guess what, you'll be smartin'. Starting to feel my flow, yeah you know, like watching a Falorian bromeliad grow. Do I trust Sisko? I don't know. But cray cray kai, Maddie Wynn, gotta go.
Brielle.
They call me
Brielle,
Hey there, girl, look into my orb. Think about all the love you could absorb. I get down, yo, like a gratitude fest. No life support, don't need no rest. Like Philip Anglum, forever best. Take your positronic implant, me, I'm blessed. Resurrect myself, no stress, no mess, no jest. Monastery to the mic, my spiritual quest. Rise from the soul to make you all heal. Power in the words, the opaca ideal. I got you a fool, cause I keep it bar real. Spinning record still done like a dabo wheel.
Brielle,
they call me
Brielle, Forever.
You truly are the Vedic with the most.
Testify.